big rocks and all that sort of thing.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello again, my friends, and millions of John Houghton fans. Welcome to the latest very special edition of You Know What. See what I did there?
Yeah.
I haven't even mentioned my name.
No, thank
you. I've mentioned your name.
Good.
Because you get a lot of fan mail.
Do I?
From men, yeah. No, young men.
Yeah, well.
That admire your voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Give us a little burst of nothing but a good time. Come on, I'll join in.
Nothing but a good time, and you won't get better than that.
No, I think it's, and it don't get, it don't better, get better than this.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. But we're sounding good, but soon, Mick, we're going to be sounding excellent, aren't we?
We really, really are, because
we've had many complaints over the years about
the
man known as Mutt Wall and his engineering prowess, which sometimes produces sounds that go in literally in one ear and out the other.
Well because I mean,
and
when
I'm
you're
saying
a certain,
that literally.
When you're as a producer,
you know,
I was talking to Mutt about this once, and he agreed with me.
Yeah.
As a producer, you know, there's a certain audio level that is beyond human
comprehension,
normal human comprehension.
And you've managed to achieve that on several occasions.
Yes, but in my quest for audio perfection, sometimes I challenge the norms.
You push the envelope. Yeah. So on the desk in front of us, barely opened, but very exciting to all those readers who have
been moaning.
Had slight concerns about the way the podcast sounds,
is a
box, and that box, Mick, contains...
It contains two Beyer Biodynamic M70 Pro X dynamic microphones. And that's what you'll be hearing...
As soon as we work out how to use them.
Also, and I fucking love this... two Beyer Dynamic. I'm sure they'll let me know.
I think it's Beyer because they're German, aren't they? So
right, but
it's all the Beyers.
All right, so they wouldn't say Beyer.
I don't know.
Beyer, you're probably right.
I'm just saying that's what
Beyer
I think.
Dynamic.
I don't know. It's based on absolutely nothing, but that's what I think.
I thought you had a German blood.
Yeah, well, probably.
Okay. Two Beyer Dynamic DT770 Pro 80. Oh my god. OHM closed dynamic.
OHM. He's such a sound.
What is OHM?
Ohm, isn't it? You know, it's like a measure of currency.
Ohm.
Yeah.
An ohm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an electrical
thing.
There's
no place like ohm, my friend. Closed dynamic headphones.
Ooh. Imagine how good we're going to sound. Because once we got the headphones, once we worked out how to use the headphones...
Once we worked out how to use the microphones...
Yeah, and the headphones, we'll be able to tell whether something is literally going in one ear and out the other.
That's right.
And correct it instantly.
We'll be able to, fact check.
I was looking at the booklet that these arrived with, and it said you can record rock and pop vocals on them.
So there's your first album in the making.
Be singing properly once those are up and running.
Yeah, and I'll go into what's it called, GarageBand, and see if I can find guitar
what's
in the style of Slash.
What's it called?
Or in your case, CC DeVille.
Yeah.
Because he's your favourite, isn't he?
He is my favourite. He's great, CC.
He is.
You'd much rather listen to CC than Slash. Slash goes on for hours.
Yeah, and that hat.
Here's one from my solo album.
Yeah, what you want is Talk Dirty to Me.
CC. On, off, done.
Yeah.
That's how CC works.
That's why they call him CC DeVille.
Ain't nothing but a good time.
Did you know, it's not true what they used to say, that he was the illegitimate offspring of Mink DeVille?
No. Well, you see, that joke is so old. It sort of depends on people knowing who Mink DeVille are.
Well,
or is, or was, or...
I think it's all part of the DeVille family. Oh. There was Cruella.
Yeah.
Mink.
Yeah, and now Cece.
And do you know who used to manage Mink DeVille?
No.
Doc McGee. Doc McGee.
You're going to say Don Arden.
Oh, my God, I had no idea until I was
working. We're going to come back to Don Arden later in the pod. Did you know that? Yeah.
Are we? Oh, okay. You can surprise me with that one. But let me just finish this quickly. Mink DeVille had one big hit, Spanish Stroll, in like the very early late 70s, very early 80s.
Right.
And Doc McGee became his manager in Doc's earliest forays into management.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if you know, but Willie DeVille, the singer of Mink DeVille.
I don't know anything about them at
all. Okay. Yeah. Well, he was a New York... you know, like West Side Story, you've got the bad guys from the east side.
Yeah.
That's Willie DeVille. And he was a well-known...
the Montagues and the Capulets.
He was what?
The Montagues and the Capulets.
Oh, yeah.
West Side Stories from Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, see, I'm more of a warriors generation. Families. I'm more warriors. You know, you classicists.
Yeah.
You guys who love... stage musicals.
Yeah, you do. You're the one talking about them. Who mentioned West Side Story?
But only because I thought, well, you'd understand
that.
Only because it's your favourite. What I'm saying is
when I got here, you were doing a couple of verses of Fiddler on the Roof.
While doing the Paso Doble.
Yeah.
It is...
Part of your makeup.
So, Willie DeVille was this sort of outlaw figure, you know, like from the gangs of the East Side, also a formidable heroin addict, and I remember saying to, because there were stories about him at the time, I remember talking to Doc about it and saying he must have been, he went, no Mick, he said it was the wife, he was a pussycat,
right.
I can't remember her fucking name, I'll have to look it up. Probably on Google.
Yeah,
but she had a name like, you know, Pussycat or something. Right, it wasn't like Susan. You know, it was like Panther DeVille.
Good.
Yeah, she
good
kicked
for her.
Ass. Yeah, I love that chick. So John, we're gonna. What's this Don Arden thing?
I was gonna say, because what we talked about, you've probably forgotten.
No, I don't know. Who are you?
Is that today's podcast? We would pay tribute to a couple of people who sadly passed in the last week since we last recorded. They have they've joined the great gig in the sky.
Yes, indeed. I mean, all kidding aside, it has been quite a sad week on the old dead rock star.
Sad week of dead rock stars. The first one was Mr. Tony the Hat Clarkin.
Tony the Hat Clarkin.
Of Magnum. I mean, a legend in his field.
Oh, no, completely. And also one half of the brilliant 80s... I don't know if you call them Magnum Prog. I suppose they were.
A bit more proggy
earlier, but then they.
Pomp.
Well, like Marillion were proggier earlier.
Yeah, but they
so
were never,
Genesis.
They, yeah, but they,
everyone's proggier.
Yeah,
earlier.
I suppose
you used to be very.
Yeah,
when
very
coached you into this new
very
job.
Prog rock. Yeah.
One half of the dynamic duo with Bob the Cat.
Catley.
Yeah. Who was a brilliant vocalist.
Superb, yeah.
So it was Bob the Cat and Tony the Hat on guitars.
Yeah, that's
all
right.
kinds of guitars.
And Tony wrote all the songs, wrote all the lyrics.
Did Bob not write any?
Bob never wrote a damn word.
That's because he was the cat.
Because he's the cat.
He's a cat, man.
He's a cat.
Cats don't sit around writing lyrics.
Yeah, the cat just turns up and sings.
Cat just turns up and does turns his
but
shit
let me
green.
Tell you, nobody interpreted a Tony Clarkin song like the cat.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. We make fun, but I mean...
It was a genuine artistic partnership.
They were a brilliant band.
Very good. Which we'll talk... So we can talk a little bit about them, and we're going to talk a little bit about the other passing, rather sad.
Which is, I think, even sadder in many ways, because... Tony was in his late 70s, still far too fucking early to go. But
James Kottak,
who had first come to fame as the drummer in Kingdom Come.
Kingdom Clone, as we used to call them.
Yeah. He died, sadly, just a week or so ago. And he was only, I think, 62.
62, 61, something like that. Yeah.
And all the stories I read all kind of circle back to the fact that he'd had a lifelong alcohol addiction issue, whatever. He'd been in rehabs. They talked about how this kept coming up. He was saying
he'd
between
been prehab.
Well, it was like he was saying, and you know, the thing is, between 2011 and 2014, I was completely alcohol free.
Yeah,
it was that sort of thing.
Yeah, that, which means in all the other years you were blind drunk.
But and also it probably means those 3 years he was what they call white knuckling it.
Yeah,
you know, just,
right. Yeah,
he probably remembers how many days
you'd
it
know
was.
About that. I wouldn't know about
me.
That.
Yeah. No,
you're always talking about that
white knuckling.
Yeah,
it. No, that's in the marriage context. as my therapist encouraged me to.
So we're going to pay fulsome tribute to James
to both
Kottak
both,
as
both.
Well.
Yeah. All right, where do you want to start?
Well, I think we should start with the hat because I think the hat. I mean
terribly
bless,
underrated.
Bless him. You say. Yeah, and he was in his late 70s. He was one of those guys, and I say this in the nicest possible way, he always seemed to be old. You know, it was like when Magnum were at their peak, which is probably late 80s, early 90s, even then there was, you know, he would appear when on his appearances in View from the Bar, it would invariably be attached to a mention of his age. You know?
Well, by the time they would have been, because I remember writing about on a Storyteller's Night.
Yeah.
The guy who did the sleeve.
Rodney Matthews.
I went all the way to Wales or wherever he used to live to interview Rodney Matthews. So this thing for Kerrang where we talked about people that had done albums.
Yeah.
And
that's a terrific... I mean, that was the moment, I think, that everything came together for Magnum. But
it was the perfect sleeve on... Probably their best sleeve on... For me,
oh, by far their best. By far their best album, without a doubt.
I mean, no, literally everyone was a winner.
Yeah, all great songs. I loved that album. I actually bought that album. Yeah. It was pre-me joining Kerrang. Loved it.
Yeah.
Because it did everything. You know, it was a perfect synthesis of Clarkin's ideas, his lyrical ideas,
and
the cover art, all of those things came together really for the first time properly, although they'd done probably five or six albums before that. But I mean, so the interesting thing about
just to finish your point, you said he always seemed old.
Yeah, which is what I was going to talk about.
Well, he was pretty much 40 by the time he did that record.
Exactly.
And I think in retrospect, I wouldn't have thought of this at the time. One of the reasons that, as you're about to elucidate on that album, I think is so good is that. It's not a guy in his 20s doing prom.
Yes, yeah. It's
not one of those, hello, mum, look what I did.
Yeah.
This is crafted.
Exactly. It's about craftsmanship and understanding the songwriting.
But completely compelling. No boring bits.
Yeah, and actually, and it took him a while. There are lots of those earlier Magnum albums, Chase the Dragon and so on, where you hear elements of what's on A Storyteller's Night, but it's not quite
there
yet.
No, that's their moment.
It's you know, you were saying it's a bit proggy. It was a bit proggy. It was a bit long-winded.
Yeah.
Whereas he then, although some of the songs on Storyteller's Night are longer than 5 minutes or what have you, there's a sort of conciseness to his songwriting where everything's in the right place. But
Yeah, go on.
Wait, so, and this is...
How Far Jerusalem.
Yeah, terrific. Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
That's an opening
track.
It's
the opening track, and it's a real epic, you know.
Yeah.
And it's one of those... we should talk a bit about this. Let's go a little bit further back.
Let's go deep,
because the reason we sort of mention his age and so on is that...
Well, it's significant.
When you look back at who his contemporaries were and are, they are from that... And Magnum are a Birmingham band. They have their roots in Birmingham. They are from that same cohort
as
Black Sabbath, Judas Priest, Led Zeppelin, all of those bands that came out of Birmingham at that time.
And
there
was half of Led Zeppelin.
Half of Led Zeppelin. And there was a certain sensibility that brought. And interestingly, I was listening to a podcast, and it was the first time I've really thought this, but I was listening to a podcast about Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, who...
who used to live around here where we are now.
He's sort of very much associated with Oxford, where he was a professor for years and where he wrote Lord of the Rings. And
the very pub I can take you to.
Exactly. But the thing about Tolkien's early, he sort of had this semi-tragic upbringing. He was orphaned by the age of 12. And when he was orphaned, him and his brother moved from an idyllic little village in Worcestershire.
Into the
middle of Birmingham. Yeah. And this is Birmingham pre-First World War.
Yeah, this is Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, this is the great industrial...
This is Peaky Blinders.
Exactly, yeah. So he moved there, and obviously that has its intimations of Mordor when you read Lord of the Rings, although a lot of that is the First World War. But Tolkien was already picking up on that. Now, if you think about the Birmingham that Clark in, Iommi, Ozzy... Mm-hmm. Rob Halford, Robert Plant, John Bonham, that they grew up in.
And that whole scene.
Yeah, that...
Because there was also... there were lots of... Roy Wood and Jeff Lynne.
Yeah, lots of musicians came. But what
Stevie Winwood.
They were growing up in a kind of desolate landscape. Yeah, yeah. But that was early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, that we wouldn't recognise now.
Mate.
It was the end of the industrialised factory era. So all of the forges and all that kind of thing was still going, but it was also bombed out after the Second World War, and there were still bits of it that hadn't been, no one bothered reviving or repairing it.
Yeah.
And it produced this kind of, you think Tolkien sort of saw it, and then you think about the lyrics of Plant, you think about the lyrics of Tony Clarkin.
J.R.R. Tolkien essentially invented progressive rock.
Exactly, yeah. You think about that influence, and then, Clarkin, the way he wrote, and the way that Geezer wrote in a slightly different way, but again...
Well, Plant was Tolkien adjacent, wasn't
he? Tolkien became this great sort of hippie icon, though he was
this
far removed.
Was he on the cover of Sgt. Pepper? He was like almost...
Oh, he probably is, isn't he?
He probably was, yeah. Also, I think Sid Barrett and those people are all kind of...
Everyone really... I mean, The Lord of the Rings is apparently the biggest selling novel in the English language.
But it only became a colossus in that regard with the mid to late 60s when rock groups...
Picked up on this
and
fantasy.
Suddenly it wasn't about hobbits and dragons, or not dragons, orcs or whatever anymore. It was the forces of...
Which is sort of what Tolkien was actually writing about these great forces that he encountered in the First World War. He fought in the First World War and just saw that kind of hellscape of what man could do.
And you listen to the craziest parts of early Zeppelin or Sabbath.
Well, you listen to Sabbath especially. I mean, that is the sound of the factories. Dun, that is the sound of, dun, post-industrial Britain. Dun.
Do you know where that riff came from for Black Sabbath? For Black Sabbath, the song. You know how it goes, obviously.
I see.
Down, down, down.
What is this that stands before me?
Sharon?
Yeah.
Yes, Iommi told me, I nicked that riff. That's not a very good accent, is it? He said, I nicked it from Holst.
Oh,
I went,
really?
What? Because it's on the phone. He goes, Holst! The planets! He got it from Mars.
The
big riff. Because Mars goes, dun, 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 dun.
Clever, you see.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun. So I just went dun, dun, dun.
See, there you go. There you go.
And he said, up to then, they had all been was trying to segue from covers into their own stuff, but were very much still doing the covers circuit, and it just wasn't happening. Every time they did their own stuff, it was fucking forget it. And they were doing the Pokey Hole. I think it was the Pokey Hole in Lichfield. The first time they ever played. And he goes, the fucking place stopped. He goes, everybody just fucking stopped and stared.
Yeah.
He said, and at the end of it.
Because no one's heard anything like
this,
that.
This is
before.
The Pokey Hole in Lichfield, probably on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's Saturday. We'll give them that. Yeah. He said, and he goes, that's when we knew we were onto something.
Yeah.
And because they'd called that song Black Sabbath, they went, well, let's do this. We'll be Black Sabbath. Yeah. We'll just do more like this.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's really interesting what you said there about the cover circuit, because that's what Tony Clarkin was on for a very long time, that Birmingham covers circuit. He was in Del Shannon's band for a while.
Well, I was going to say,
Magnum would do, you know, pop covers of the time. I think their first single was something like a cover of Sweets for My Sweet. You know,
Tony was born in 1946, so by 1966 he's 20.
Yeah,
he's already out and about, man.
Yeah, so they, and that was how a professional musician, I guess, who wasn't from London and not on the sort of session circuit that Jimmy Page was on, for example, where
down in London,
he's not on that. In Birmingham, it's covers bands.
It's Mothers.
Yeah, it's got play at the pub,
Pokey Hole.
Yeah,
it's all these.
Well, I think Magnum were associated with the Rum Runner, which was a pub that would later become famous because Duran Duran started off there.
Yeah, yeah, big venue in Birmingham.
Yeah
absolutely. By the way, just to verify what you said, I love this new, more factual approach. Sweets for My Sweet was in fact the very first Magnum.
There you go.
Single.
See, I remember them saying him talking about that.
And I'm going to tell you when it was released. It was released. It was released.
It would have been early 70s, I imagine.
Yeah, it says here. Oh, no, hang on, mate. Bear with me. I've got it. It was released as a non-album single in 1975.
Yeah, okay, so that's, yeah.
Now, at that point, Tony Clarkin would have already been 29.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
so
they didn't get another single out for 3 years.
Yeah, and by that point, and this is where obviously Don Arden enters the story, is that they sign to Jet Records. Actually signed, I think, by David Arden. So I think David was allowed out. David Don's son, Sharon's brother, doing a bit of A&R or what have you. He's the one who actually signs Magnum.
I'm just doing a bit of research here, John. Yeah, did you know?
He could have done this before the show.
Well, I didn't,
did you know that?
Could I?
Yeah.
Could,
yeah. Instead of looking at the microphone box and going, oh, I wonder how I get that open. Linda, show me how to open
that
the
was
microphone
me.
Box?
This is what you don't see. You swan in, shit green, and just parachute out again. You bail, you know. But hours, sometimes days before you actually arrive, you know, thanks for showing up. I'm amongst the weeds with the equipment, sound design. Yeah. So don't give me all that. Anyway, what I was going to say is Tony Clarkin is 2 years older than Tony Iommi.
Right, well, there you go. Yeah.
So that really
very
does.
Generationally, that's where he is. Yeah. David Arden signs them to Jet Records. And this, I mean, you'd know a lot more about this era.
David Arden was like good cop. You know, Don was like beyond bad cop.
Yeah. So who would Jet have had on the label around that point, sort of late 70s?
ELO.
Yeah.
ELO were major.
So they're a big label. I mean, it's one of the biggest bands in the world at that point, probably.
Yeah.
Certainly in Europe.
Oh, and America. They were enormous. Right. Yeah. It was through ELO that Don was able to buy... In 1977, he was able to buy Howard Hughes's old mansion for cash.
Yeah. So you can see Magnum signing to Jet at that point. That's a decent deal if you're coming up for 30 or whatever it is and you've not really got yourself going yet.
Well, also, and also at that point, Don was still managing Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
ELO were huge in America, and he was at his peak.
I mean, forgive my ignorance. I'm sure you told me this before, but is Don from the Midlands? Because you think about they're all Midland, you know, ELO and Midlands band. And
well, there's just such a great pool of talent there.
Yeah,
I mean, Traffic and The Move.
Yeah.
And
so he's not sort of waiting for people to come through his door. He's getting out there and looking for them.
Well, by the time. You know, all of those came to London to seek their fortunes. And by then, Don was already Don.
He
was already Mr. Big.
He was the Don.
Yeah. So if he showed interest, you were fucking delighted.
Yeah.
Because also, you know, Ozzy was signed to Jet. 78 was when their first album was released, Kingdom of Madness, talking about Magnum, that came out in August 78. And at that point, Ozzy has just broken up with Sabbath.
Yeah.
So he's got a solo deal with Jet. Gary Moore's got a deal with Jet.
And you've got to remember, like, 79 or whatever, metal's about to happen in a really big way. It's about to have 1980 and 1981, which are its two, certainly for the new wave British heavy metal and for Motörhead and Maiden and all of those bands. They're the formative years. This is the point. If you're a British rock band, this is a really good time to have a record deal.
It is. But, of course, they weren't exactly... especially in the early days, like on first viewing, this is before video, this is photographs and going to the show. They weren't exactly the most, they weren't like a young Def Leppard.
No, they're not a starry looking band, as it were. And the sound in those, I mean, you think about Kingdom of Madness, and that Kingdom of Madness, the title track goes on to be, I mean, I think that was always in their set from then onwards, because it's got a great riff or what have you. But when you listen to those albums, they're not brilliantly produced. We spoke about the songs. The songs aren't amazing, you know. And they have these, Kingdom of Madness and Magnum 2, I think. They try and get probably a couple of singles away. They don't. And they kind of miss the boat at that point.
Yeah. Well, I think also...
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm just checking their producers here for those big albums. They were a slow build, and I think they came from an era in the music business where slow builds were, for an album band, a band that's going to have a career beyond being on Top of the Pops a few times. It was about a slow build.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that was acceptable, but then, I mean, I don't know, you would probably comment better than I, what are the sort of internal dynamics at Jet when you've got all these successful acts, you've got a band that doesn't really do it after a couple of albums, they're knocking on a bit in age, they're signed by David rather than by Don,
Let me answer that question. I mean, I don't know if it's the answer, but my reading, according to that authoritative source Wikipedia, the first Magnum album, Kingdom of Madness, got to number 58 in the UK chart. Now, obviously, that's not a hit, but it ain't bad.
It's not a miss.
No, it's not for a first album.
Yeah, this is when albums are selling.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So they would have been doing the college circuit. Yeah. You know, they probably did some sessions on Radio One, Tommy Vance or Alan Freeman or whatever it was in those days. Second album comes out a year later in 79, and that's a flop-a-rooney. And there is there's a 3-year gap until their next.
A hiatus, as we said.
A hiatus. And that's Chase the Dragon, which actually gets to number 17.
Yeah, and Chase the Dragon, I think, was their sort of. That was really where Tony had kind of got it together. That's got, I think it's got The Spirit on there, which was a song that. They always stay with it. It's probably got Soldier of the Line. Sacred Hour is probably on there, which was another.
Yep, Sacred Hour.
So by this point, I think Mark Stanway has joined on keyboards. He plays the famous intro to Sacred Hour.
It is Mark Stanway. He was a good guy, actually. He was fantastic. Well, they had humour.
So Chase the Dragon was a pretty big album, I think, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean,
and then they did another album after that, I think, and then that was a bit of a flopperoonie. And this is all
they did the eleventh hour,
which wasn't
the following
so good.
Year.
By this point, they've got the Rodney Matthews sleeves. He definitely did Chase the Dragon. I'm pretty sure he did 11th Hour as well.
If I show you that, I'm showing John the evidence.
Oh, there it is. Yeah,
you don't even have to ask who that
that's
is.
Rodney Matthews. Yeah.
Was it like dinosaur, dragon, alien things on a
looking
alien
at, looking
world.
At a mystical city. Yeah, the classic Matthews.
I'm assuming they're dragons.
And actually, if you look back, I'm pretty sure. I know he didn't. This wasn't Rodney Matthews, but it's that classic sort of sci-fi type illustration that you got on a load of those books, but also Yesod used on something like Fragile, probably.
Well, they had Roger Dean.
They had Roger Dean.
When I was saying, I think, before we hit the airwaves, in about 85, I did a story for Kerrang on...
I think you just said that on this podcast.
Did I say that on this?
Yeah.
Did I?
You did.
Okay. No need to rewind there.
You went to Wales to see Rodney Matthews.
Oh, fuck, I did. Okay, okay. What I'm saying is on that same journey, I went to Brighton to
and
Roger
saw
Dean's
Roger
house.
Roger Dean, yeah.
Not just Roger, but also his brother Martin Dean.
Oh, okay.
Because Roger designed all the trippy fold-out gatefold.
Yeah,
Tales of Topographic Oceans, yeah. Close to the Edge, all of them. And his brother Martin... design the stage shows.
Oh wow.
Which were based on the album covers.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean they were all sort of like, you know, weird shaped rocks that had whole cities built on them and things like that. So,
Tales of Topographic Oceans.
Oh, that's Matt. Well, that's Matt's got all the fish kind of swimming under.
Are they fish?
Yeah, well, are they fish?
Are they sentient?
I'm sure that's a multi-dimensional question.
Multi-dimensional beings.
I'm sure that's a question you put to Roger Dean.
He was pleasingly eccentric.
Yes, I bet he was.
He didn't look like he'd been outside that cottage or the valley for...
Yeah.
Possibly since birth, you know.
So, just to drag us back onto
Magnum.
Oh,
sorry, let me finish.
Well, by the point, I'm going to keep you moving along here, because by the time they come to do On a Storyteller's Night, which is after, I think, the 11th Hour, they've fallen on hard times. They signed to a new label, which is, rather fantastically, FM Revolver, which was a legendary label at the time when I started at Kerrang, run by a guy called Paul Birch.
It's true. But also, they got a... Because their kind of music was always popular in Europe, particularly Germany, Polydor in Germany, massive, probably the biggest record label in Europe, signed them... Polydor in Germany signed for Europe.
Oh, right, okay.
So begins their...
Sort of, if they had a glory era, they're just about to come into it.
Absolutely.
Really.
Yeah, Storyteller comes out.
So Birch signs him. Birch at the time. I mean, he was an amazing figure. I'd describe him. He was like probably sort of 6'5", something like that, with like load of really blonde hair, rail thin, cowboy boots, like a bit of a rocker himself. You know?
I think bit of is an understatement.
Well, I mean, a lot of a rocker. He signed Magnum, but he'd also signed our old chums, Marino. Marino definitely did an album.
How the fuck do you manage to shoehorn?
This was how I got to know Paul Birch, because through Marino, who was constantly driving him insane, because Marino had done an album for him.
Marino was kind of like the Del Boy of the music business.
Very much
except could
that's
really
a perfect description.
Except could was Del really
Boy,
good
Del
looking
Boy,
and could play the shit out of the guitar.
Del Boy, but from Hull.
Yeah. It was like, you speak French, don't you, Del Boy? Yeah. Mon
peu.
Yeah. I put a little clip up.
What he was like.
It was a great scene. It went on the internet and I tweeted it as well, where a vintage early days of Only Fools, and they're in the pub and there's this poor woman, young woman, attractive, lost, but she doesn't speak English. And the landlord says to Del, "Hey, Del, you speak French, don't you?" And he's like, "You know, potage." and so he goes, "Oh, yeah." He goes to Rodney, he goes, "You stay here, Rodney." Rodney goes, you're gonna speak French to someone. I wouldn't miss that for £1 million. So he goes over there. There's this woman, she's sitting there, and she's like, "Oh, Del looks at him and goes, "Au revoir."
That's it. I mean, that that would be a very... And really, it was a kind of eye-opening thing for me, because I just sort of started at Kerrang. And when you when I started off, you sort of imagined record companies to all be like the majors were, which would be in a huge office and, you know, you have reception and everyone's got loads of money and everyone gives you free albums.
Because but actually, in those days, that was the presentation.
But actually, a lot of the labels that were really kicking out the albums, or certainly the albums that got bands going, so I'm thinking of Music for Nations, who had Metallica and all of that.
Roadrunner,
who had a whole slew of bands. FM Revolver, who had Magnum, obviously, he had a really big album with Magnum, because... And Storyteller's Night becomes a really big seller. It gets into the charts and it does it incredibly well. So, but FM Revolver was sort of, you know, I'm not saying it was run out the back of a car, but it was, you know, it's not like all of a sudden it's like, oh, hang on, you can actually run a record company from, not from your front room, but from a smaller office, and you just got a couple of people there. And these people like Paul Birch, I'm thinking of Phil Scott at Roadrunner.
Oh, yeah.
He was a legend. You know, he's just like, knew everybody, knew everything. You know, and so lots of labels like that that just, you know, were a kind of, I mean, they're either a stepping stone up for a band like Metallica, who no one has signed yet,
right?
Or they're sort of a stepping stone down,
yeah,
for someone like Magnum, who've come off Jet, but actually they're still in with a shout.
They've still got an audience, it's just more select.
Yeah.
Well, you've kind of just, you beat me to it. I was going to say, Asia signed to them at one point.
Right. Oh, now, really?
Wow. Yeah, well, the first two Asia albums were mental.
Yeah.
But we're talking about, you know, later in the game.
Yeah.
But they also had that guy, Adam Bomb. Do you remember?
Adam Bomb, I remember him. He was from New York, wasn't he?
Yeah, didn't he come in the office and
annoy
us?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
I think so, yeah. Anyway, loads of those.
But so they do on a Storyteller's Night, and it's like, bam, all of a sudden.
Yeah.
They're the kind of band, I would say, they're a Hammersmith Odeon band. So they're not
by this point. Definitely.
Yeah, they're not going to be doing Wembley, but they do a really solid gig tour. You know, where they're doing 2,000 and 3,000 seater halls, and they're doing, you know, pretty well. I would say pretty well.
Well, I tell you what,
and so then they signed. They, I mean, this is one of those classic sort of music business things. Paul Birch loses them, whether he'd only signed them for one album or what have you.
Well, they went on to Polydor.
They go on to Polydor in the UK as well. So I'm sure. Money changed hands.
Oh,
as it
a bit
were.
Like when Metallica left Music for Nations, ended up on, funny enough, not Polydor, but Polygram, Phonogram.
Yeah, yeah.
Same
thing. So, the, you know, they're acting almost as kind of A&R people for the bigger labels as well.
So, moving it on, because we have got other dead rock
well,
stars.
We do. Just the funny thing to say is the next album, so they've got all this money now, all this money. Relatively, they've got a lot of money.
Yeah.
And their next album, Vigilante, which is hilarious in many terms, they're suddenly being produced by Roger Taylor.
Which is where I'm going to pick up the tale.
Good.
Because you're quite right. Vigilante...
And it's like, what, hang on, why Roger Taylor? It's just a weird thing. What else had Roger Taylor produced at that point? He wasn't producing Queen, that was Roy Thomas Baker. So why...
Well,
Roger Taylor.
Well, hang on. I'm going to see if I can answer that, you see. Wikipedia.
While Mick Wall is looking this up, which he should have done earlier. I'll just describe the cover of Vigilante, which I think they might have briefly kicked poor old Rodney Matthews into touch, or Rodney wasn't available.
I can't be bothered to fucking.
Because they came out with the album cover for Vigilante.
I think it was.
It's got a sort of pink unicorn on the front.
It has. Here's my memory with David Richards, who'd worked with Queen, I think, was going to work with Magnum. And I think it was through that connection that he went, "Hey, why don't I ask Roger?"
Yeah.
And Roger came in because at that stage, Magnum were, because of Storyteller, and they were on the cover of Kerrang.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
In those days, that meant you, you know, didn't always mean you'd made it, but they were now regulars.
Yeah.
And... I went with Fish. This is the legendary story of when I ended up at Roger Taylor's gaff.
Yeah.
Magnum were playing the Odeon. We all wanted to see them because they were just always great. Fish wanted to go. And I thought, yeah, come and see our proper fucking band.
Yeah, see what proper singer sounds like.
No, we all went because it was fun. And Roger Taylor came, and us and some other people. And they were fantastic. But, of course, you know, we did spend a fair amount of time upstairs with Marco in the bar, backstage
bar. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But afterwards, party at Roger Taylor's.
Right.
All of Magnum are there. Loads of people. Fish. I don't know. And loads of women. And I think... And Roger Taylor had this... It was like out of...
Roger Taylor had loads of women.
Yes, he did.
Amazing.
And he's walking around in his sunglasses. Yeah. It's like one in the morning. He's wearing his sunglasses. And he's got the shag...
Because you have to say that like Roger had it going on, didn't he? He's a kind of good-looking guy.
Yeah, yeah, this is 1986.
Yeah.
They've just come back recently.
They've done Live Aid.
The year before. Yeah. But that... It's coming back to me now. That summer, they'd done all these German and European football stadiums with Marillion opening.
That's right. And they did Nebworth, didn't they?
In 86?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
I think it was the year after Live Aid, I think. They did a huge...
Probably same tour.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
I'm sure it was, in fact. Yeah. So he's just come off that, because it's probably autumn. They're touring in the autumn, probably. The album came out end of September, so this would be October, November.
Yeah.
Typical Hammersmith Odeon Saturday night, but he's got the it's out of the cliche manual. He's got this really thick shag pile carpet that your feet disappear into, and everything's white, the couches, everything.
Yeah.
And
that's how I'd have it.
Look, as you can see, John, I live in some splendor myself.
Yeah.
Very. I'm not so much colour coordinated, though, am I?
No, I wouldn't say so.
I like to blend and
shape. You like to mix and match.
Fuck off. Anyway, so we go to the gig. It's a brilliant gig. We end up at Roger Taylor's. And I've got a goblet of red wine. Because, of course, you can't get a glass.
No, no.
But it's in slow... See, it's
that like seems to me to be a slight recipe for disaster.
Oh.
Mick Wall is at a party at Roger Taylor's where everything is white. And you, presumably by this point, it wasn't your first goblet of red wine.
No, not at all. No, this is very much sort of...
Your fifth or sixth goblet.
Just past the peak, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I remember saying, I got to sit down. I remember that.
Yeah.
So I sat on this immaculate white couch.
Yeah.
And...
looking for somewhere to balance your goblet.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I'd necked about half of it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, you know. And it's a fucking goblet. So I just want to put it down somewhere. And I'm looking and there's nowhere. So I thought... I wonder if I could just sort of nestle it.
screw it into the
shag pile.
Yeah.
Because I tell you what, it seemed feasible.
Yeah, because the shag pile was so deep, it would hold a goblet of
red
wine.
They were like really big, thick.
Yeah.
Because
also it has the added advantage, if you left it on the floor, there's no chance of anyone kicking it over.
Well, here's exactly what happened. Because also, you know, it's a party, so people are standing around and laughing and moving around. Yeah. Disgusting. I literally thought, that's a fucking good idea, you know. So I lean over, I get it all nestled in there. I get the cut shag all round the stem.
Yeah.
That'll be all right for a minute. And literally, as I sat up, before I'd even got to full sitting up position, a woman kicked it over. And half a goblet of this red wine went all over the shag pile and bits of the wall. And Roger, with his sunglasses, looked over and he went, "My carpet."
Yeah, of course he did.
And I'm going, "Oh, man." Yeah. You know, like, "I'm so sorry."
Yeah.
I'm so, man, what can I say? I'm really sorry. Where's the wine? Because I've got an empty glass now. Empty goblet. Yeah. So that's my Magnum story.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, to very quickly go back to the cover of...
Wings of Heaven?
No, of Vigilante.
Because this wasn't Rodney Matthews.
Yeah, it had a unicorn.
There you go.
with a pink I mean,
for today's
climate. I mean, they're just like 40 years ahead of their time. People would love this shit now. A pink unicorn. But they had a brilliant launch party for the album.
Did they?
Maggie Farren's place.
Yeah.
Do you remember Maggie Farren's
Farren
place?
Was old school.
Yeah, PR.
Rock and roll PR in the 80s. But I mean, Maggie had been around since the 60s, really.
Yeah. And she had a play in the same building that Ray Palmer had his photographic studio.
Ladies' Man Palmer.
So you imagine that. And it was like this big, it was one of those sort of old sort of warehouse spaces or factory spaces that was converted into.
I went there many times.
It was in, it was sort of West London, one of those bits of West London you can never work out quite where it is. But
sort of northwest London.
Yeah, sort of that, you know, Kilburn, maybe. Not even Kilburn. Like one of those places you just don't really know where it. Westbourne Grove. Is that what it's called? Westbourne Park?
Could be. Some
place like that that doesn't have a tube station. It doesn't have any. So we go to this party at Maggie Farren's, and some wag has decided that they would get a horse, because a horse a horse on the club.
Oh, you mean a unicorn?
No, and they would attach a unicorn.
A unicorn horn.
A unicorn horn.
They would attach
a
horn to the horse's head, presumably.
And bring it in, yeah, yeah.
But on a lead.
On a lead,
what do you call those
on the wings of heaven, they brought it in.
Did it have, hang on.
I'm trying to remember what happened.
Hang on. I'm just trying to find the album cover now, because you've piqued my interest. Yeah. What the fuck is it? Oh, here we go. Oh, no. You'd never believe it, John.
I suppose the point being that it was one of those things that showed just how much money was sloshing around in the music business in those days. Yeah, so
the good old days, mate.
Yeah, you know, you just had enough money for a party to get a horse. Maggie Farren is obviously, he was doing their PR by that point. Maggie Farren has obviously hunted around for a horse.
Was it white?
And then, I can't even remember if it was white. It must have been white.
Listen.
This is jogging my memory now. It's like, I'm sure that everyone was agog at this party because Joey Tempest was there. And it was like the era when Europe were absolutely the
86,
fucking biggest band. Yeah. You know, and
did you get his autograph?
Not only
I bet you did.
I did. Not only getting a
Joey.
Not only getting a horse, but then thinking, how do I attach a unicorn's horn to make it look like the album cover
and to make it plausible and convincing?
Yeah, exactly,
you see, it's very important.
And then what are we going to do? Well, we're going to lead it into the part. I mean, it's insane. It's insane, but it's funny, you know.
Yeah. And but how did they attach it?
I can't remember.
Oh, come on. I thought
honestly
you were going to say
remember.
It was like a bit of
I think it probably was. Well, what else did you
know,
glue
thin,
it or,
thin elastic.
Yeah, just turn it into a bit of a hat as well. So. I can't remember. But so that
they
was
probably
sort of
had
the stage
to sedate the horse.
And then the next time, so I interviewed them a few times. And actually, the other thing we should say about Tony, which is a very noble thing, which he did bang in the middle of all this when no one else was doing it, was he was known as the hat because he always had a big beard and long straggly hair and this hat.
Yeah, I think it was mainly because he always had a hat.
Exactly. So he was called
beard, was
but
it?
We all knew why the hat was there.
Keep
and we
the
all
sweat out of
exactly
his eyes.
And we all knew he was a bit old. So in the middle of all this, I remember one day Maggie Farren saying, I'm sending over a picture of Magnum. I thought, why are you phoning me to say this?
hold the front page. Right there,
but
yeah,
it was a bloody hold. It was at
least hold
view from the bar, because when it turned up, Tony had shaved his head.
Oh,
he'd
yeah.
done the full.
That's right.
And it was before anyone was doing that thing. Yeah. You know, he just like
where
shaved his
head. Where do you think
I
got
it from? Like, yeah.
I have got what's known as a Tony Clarkin.
Yeah. Kept a bit of the beard,
hatless.
But shaved it. And that was the look he kept. Because he looked great. It looked way better. I mean,
of course
way
it did.
Better than all the hair and the hat and stuff. He suddenly looked great, you know. So, he did that in the middle of all this. And then, I think I went to LA to
Hang on, can I just pause you here? Are we going through the whole history of Magnum here? Or can we, you know, come to an agreeable conclusion? Because I think you're getting carried away, you know.
Yeah.
He was a fantastic guy.
Terrific guitarist. Yeah, fantastic guy, but a very understated man. Yeah. I mean, if you asked him about songwriting or anything, he was a bit like Tony Iommi in that he'll just go, "Well, I don't know, really." Yeah, I just.
Jeff Lynne's the same.
Yeah,
I think
maybe it's a Midlands thing.
Yeah, certain reserve. You know? Yeah, you don't want to be boastful.
But it's just like they, you know, you, same with Iommi. You say to him, like you were saying about how he came up with the planets.
Yeah,
you
know,
it's just like really, if he tells you that, you think, oh, I've got quite a bit out of it.
Yeah.
They just didn't speak a lot. You know, certainly in relation to someone like Stars or something, you're telling the ins and outs of every single note on the album.
That's the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
No, this is the Midlands. These guys were born in the 40s. You know, they grew up with bomb craters and unexploded God knows what, you know. No telly, no phone, no car, no fuck all.
Yeah.
They made their own entertainment.
And exactly. It's
a cliche that it is, they had to get on with it.
Yeah, that's very true. And they did. And, you know, I saw, just to round off Tony Clark and his career, that actually there was an album due to come out, I think, this week. They'd recorded an album and it was ready to go. And they'd planned a tour that was cancelled just before he died, because obviously they knew he was ill.
Right.
So there was right up to the very end of his life, he'd remained incredibly productive. Because you think every song on every Magnum album, with, I suppose, the exception of Sweets for My Sweet, is by Tony Clarkin.
Yeah.
He wrote the lot. So hats off to the hat, I say.
Hats off to the hat. Very well put, John. Well done.
A great gentleman. Yes, indeed. The music business.
Now, a guy we didn't know nearly as well, but we were very much aware of the first band he became famous in, which was Kingdom Come. And the drummer on that album was, is it Kotak?
I think it's Kotak.
Kotak.
James Kotak. Well, James Kotak. They're an extraordinary band. I mean, I remember them turning up at Kerrang, the album turning up. And it was one of those jaw-dropping moments. When you hear the album now, it actually doesn't sound as much like Led Zeppelin as everyone thought it did. But back then it was like, my God, these people have just completely ripped off Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
But they had this amazing singer who was a former hairdresser from Germany called
Lenny Wolf,
who was a great character.
Get in line, you know, ladies.
Yeah, he was a great character, Lenny, and did all the press and puffed his chest out and was great on stage.
It was a fantastically entertaining album.
It was. It was a brilliant record. And the thing you have to say, and the next couple of records were pretty decent as well.
Can I tell you my Kingdom Come story, though?
Well, please do. But can I just say, in the tribute to James Kotak, the one thing you need in a Led Zeppelin-style band is a thunderous drummer.
He was
very much a thunderous drummer, yeah.
He, in those days, he was probably the closest to Bonham I had heard.
Wow.
But we're talking about, what, 88?
Yeah, it must have been 88, 89, something like that.
So I reviewed that album for Craig. And not only did I do that, but I gave a copy to Jimmy Page.
Oh, wow.
Who I was doing some stuff with at the
time.
Yeah,
yeah.
And
because that's what everyone wanted to know.
Yeah.
That was the first question. Like, what does Jimmy Page think of it? What does Robert Plant think of it?
So I said, what did you think of it? He goes, I fell off the bed laughing.
I remember that quote now.
Right.
Didn't that get on the front of Kerrang? It probably did.
Probably did.
Yeah, yeah. Because it was relayed to Lenny Wolf, I believe.
Well, this story gets better.
Yeah.
So I review the album. And I don't know if we gave... I think we did give, I know it was K's, but did we give star ratings yet?
Yeah,
I think
I'm sure we did. I'm sure it got the...
Well, I gave it 3.
Right.
And tried to say, look, it's brilliant, but it's a photocopy.
Yeah.
It's a fax. And that's why I can't get fully involved. But obviously it's Kerrang in 1988, so I've probably got a few licks in.
That's right. Well, they've been on the cover as well by that point, because I think Jeff put them on the cover almost as soon as the album came in. Yeah. So already there's this aura of hype about what's going on.
So cut to the summer of 88. When was the American Monsters of Rock tour? 88. They're on it. They're the opening act.
They were, that's right, yeah.
And the album is
Van
now...
Van Halen were on it, weren't they? And
say what?
Who else was it? It was Van
Kingdom
Halen.
Come, Dokken.
Yeah.
Oh, no, hang on. Metallica were very low on the bill.
Yeah.
Van Kingdom Come would have been higher than Metallica. So it would have been Metallica, Kingdom Come, Dokken, and then maybe Van Halen.
Yeah.
Dokken, Scorpions, Band.
Van Halen.
So, I've reviewed the album. I've also talked about it on, I don't know if I ever mentioned, I once did a very popular show on television.
Yeah.
I'd taken the piss and made fun and got a link out of it, you know. And so anyway, and I've probably now also interviewed Jimmy Page and all that. I go on the Monsters of Rock tour, and the very first night, I'm coming down in the lift with Ross. The lift doors open on our floor. Guess who's in the lift?
Yeah, got to be Lenny.
All of the band.
All of them.
All of the fucking band. And Ross is like, because he's not thinking of me.
Yeah.
Ross is like, in order, Kingdom Come. Like he does.
Yeah.
Or did. And I'm like, no. And Ross goes, you know Mick. They went, oh, yeah. Fucking know him.
Yeah, we know him. Yeah, yeah.
Fucking know him. And honestly, they weren't smiling.
No, Lenny took it incredibly seriously, which is why he was funny.
Yeah.
Because he just took it absolutely seriously.
Well, it didn't seem very fucking funny in that lift. Tour's closed and I'm in the lift with Kingdom Come and Ross.
That was a long trip to the ground.
It was probably only two or three floors. Two or three of the longest floors. And at the end, no one said a word apart from Ross, who was wittering away, but even he got the vibe. And the doors opened and they just kind of got out and stood around. And I had to, yeah, so that was fun.
Yeah, fun with a capital
but Kotak.
Yeah, so he then went on, he did Kingdom Come, then he did Scorpions. He was in the Scorpions, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he did a couple of albums with Kingdom Come. I think that was as long as
they
lasted.
They certainly did three, because they did one called Hands of Time. And then their third album was magnificently titled In Your Face.
I think that was because they were trying to say...
Oh, it was directed at you.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, John, because I've long wondered, you know, if that might be the case.
Yeah. And didn't the Scorpions have had a... I don't know what that... Wasn't there something appalling happened to the Scorpions drummer?
I think there was a bizarre gardening accident.
So they had James Cossack in that. So then he was a guy just sort of jobbed around, wasn't he?
Kingdom Come came out in 1988. And In Your Face came out the following year. And then 2 years after that came Hands of Time.
Exactly what I said.
Which was just as grunge was.
Yeah.
So they were a done deal. But James, you're right, he did go. He was way in the Scorpions, way longer than he was Kingdom Come.
Yeah.
And he was a brilliant drummer. What were you saying about the original? The original?
The what?
Drummer in the Scorpions?
Yeah, I had a feeling there was something. Wasn't it Herman the German?
Well, Herman the German was the accountant.
Oh, okay.
He wasn't a very good drummer, but he was apparently a very good accountant.
Yeah, which is what you need.
Like Judas Priest, didn't they have for a while, didn't they have some other guy actually doing the drumming beneath the stage or something?
I don't know. It was probably James Kotak.
He was a fantastic...
very good drummer. So he did all of that and then he...
Yeah, he joined the Scorpions in time for Evil... Oh, no, sorry, not Evil. Eye to Eye. Like human eye. Two, like the numerals. Eye, like the human eye. Do you get it?
Yeah, I get it.
Eye to Eye.
Yeah.
James was the drummer on that. And the following year's Moment of Glory.
Okay.
A lot of people, it's all right! Sorry, go on.
No, that was it. And then I don't know what happened to him after that.
He was with the Scorpions right up till the most recent album he played on was Return to Forever, which was 2015.
Oh, well, there you go.
But, I mean, the stories, I mean, I just, you know, it's not worth really getting into because I didn't know him really.
No.
But the stories you read are that the guy had an alcohol problem and it never quit.
Yeah. Well, let's not dwell on that.
Apparently the Scorpions had at the time had a drum riser with all these steps leading, because you imagine the Scorpions, you want to be...
Oh, yeah, they'd have like a 50-foot high drum riser or something.
And it became a problem because...
Somewhat precarious if you've had a couple of liveners before the gig.
If you are perhaps seeking medicinal inspiration.
Yeah,
and apparently fell down it a few times. So the signs were there.
The signs were there if you knew what to look for.
But listen, God bless him. He's too young. 62.
Yeah, too young to go, but well drummed.
You're nearly 62 now, aren't you? Don't fall down the drum riser.
No, I'll try not to.
I think that's our message.
A lesson for life.
Yeah, God bless Tony Clarkin and James Cotan.
Until next time, stay above the drum riser.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How do I stop this, Fern?